We are outside, and so you might hear some of the garden birds, the wind, and the aspen. This interview was recorded remotely with Matt in Florida and me in Utah, alongside two dachshunds and a chihuahua mix happily occupied with yak chews. Unfortunately, my local recording picked up extra pops and crackles from their enthusiastic chewing. If you hear them, just imagine a fire crackling in the corner of a goblin tavern. The dogs were thrilled, and Matt shares some really fascinating stories and insights. This episode contains themes and descriptions that may not be suitable for younger listeners. Parental discretion is advised, particularly due to the discussion of fantasy character and game design, including illustrators taking some creative liberties when depicting female goblins. From A Midsummer's Night Dream by William Shakespeare, a wood near Athens, a fairy speaks. Over hill, over dale, through bush, through briar, over park, over pale, through flood, through fire, I do wander everywhere, swifter than the moon's sphere, and I serve the fairy queen, to dew her orbs upon the green, the cowslips tall her pensioners be. In their gold coats spots you see, those be rubies, fairy favors. In those freckles live their savors. I must go seek some dewdrops here, and hang a pearl in every cowslip's ear. Farewell, thou lob of spirits, I'll be gone. Our queen and all her elves come here anon. Today we're lucky to be joined by Matt King, Associate Professor in the Department of History at the University of South Florida, author of A History of Goblins, and a new dad. Congratulations to Matt and his family. So why is this so right up our alley? Because goblins linger in folklore, fear, stories, and illustrations. Dark mining shafts, little green men, household spirits. These fantasy creatures have come into games like World of Warcraft and Dungeons and Dragons, so they have had some great staying power in storytelling. Matt's book gives us the history of how goblins have evolved. There's also the angle about the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter and the strangeness uncovered in Hellier, Kentucky. Links are in Patreon for more on these. Welcome to the Whispering Gallery, Matt. I'm excited to talk goblins with you. In the beginning here, I don't know if you remember where you first heard about goblins or if you've had any strange experiences or paranormal experiences that you would be willing to share, just since we're kind of on that line of thinking with our podcast.
Oh, for sure. I mean, if I had any, I would be happy to share them, but I have no personal interactions beyond the world of, you know, Tolkien and Ren Fairs and the world of kind of fiction and fantasy. I don't know exactly when I first heard the word. I think the most, like, enduring and early encounter I had was with The Hobbit beneath the Misty Mountains, and I think that transitioned pretty seamlessly into the fantasy world of, like, Dungeons and Dragons. And that idea of the goblin that I had going into this book, even though I encountered some of the earlier, like, folkloric ideas that were behind Tolkien, that fantasy idea is the one that has stuck with me the most.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I think The Hobbit was one of my first early classics that I read and was able to get into like that and just completely absorbed. And then I was like, they made a movie? I mean, it was a great movie, too. But yeah, it just was like I had it all mapped out, you know?
Yeah, and it's fascinating too, and like thinking about Tolkien, like he wrote The Hobbit more for his own children, and it was based on, you know, like his own encounters with like medieval folklore and like the works of George MacDonald. And so you have this like children's themed book, The Hobbit. And then when he gets into Middle Earth, he wanted to divorce himself from that like fairy tale setting kind of. Mm-hmm. And so goblins become orcs. Like in a preface to The Hobbit, he says they're the same creature, but they're very different in scope in The Lord of the Rings versus The Hobbit, where like The Hobbit, they're like singing and they're kind of comical, even though they slaughtered without remorse. But the
yeah,
they are a different other beast entirely.
Yeah, I noticed that in your book about goblins are just kind of able to be a throwaway character, so to speak. You know, they can be slaughtered, and it's just like, wow. And yet they're intelligent, you know, so it's kind of a strange balance that's been struck for them, you know?
Yeah, and Tolkien scholars are, oh man, it's a bit of a battlefield. It feels like at times when reading these works, when scholars are debating like, well, is Tolkien saying that orcs, these bad guys, are they like non-European others? Or are they like allegorical forces of evil in a Catholic fantasy world? Like, it's unclear to me. It's probably a little bit of both. But the layers and the depths that we get in discussions of like orcs and goblins and what they actually mean and are is really something I had no idea of going into writing this book in the first place.
Yeah, that's interesting that they do deep dives that way. Do you have a favorite urban legend or cryptid as we're getting to know you?
Oh, man. I don't know if I have a favorite legend. I mean, growing up in the Pacific Northwest, I do have a soft spot for Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And I'm, like, interested in just kind of, like, that idea of the solitary creature that exists just outside of human existence, and it doesn't really make biological sense if there's only one of them, you know? And
yeah.
And so I think I have a real soft spot for that. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, kind of enmeshed in the iconography of part of the Pacific Northwest. Like,
oh, yeah.
Seattle Supersonics mascot at one point, I think it was the Sasquatch or Bigfoot or something like that.
Yeah, so and music festivals, and yeah, I see it. Yeah. We go up to Oregon a fair amount, so yeah, it's kind of all over. I wasn't sure if I saw one of these last night, but do you have a reading list in your book or documentaries you mention? Or?
I mean, I have a bloated bibliography at the end of each chapter.
Okay.
And so there's a lot there. It's really like, it's a lot. I would say just in general, the authors who I tend to gravitate towards are Simon Young, Sabina Magliocchio for like modern paganism. There's a ton, and it depends on which aspect of folklore and goblins generally you're looking at. Mm-hmm. But those are the ones that come to mind.
Okay. Yeah, if you wanted to like send me just maybe your top five. With your book coming out, how did you get involved in the study of goblins, and how did it evolve into a book?
So I am a historian of the medieval Mediterranean and the history of the Crusades by training, and I kind of got burnt out just doing so much of this very heavy work on interfaith violence and coexistence, and the language issue is also really difficult. I'm looking at Arabic and Latin texts, and then like in modern scholarship we've got French, German, and Italian, and I was just like, I need a break from this. It's really hard, and I've been doing it for like a decade. And so I decided to try to do like a fun side project that ended up being an article in the journal Folklore about taxonomizing goblin from folklore to fantasy. Mm-hmm. In which I look at how vague they were in most folklore, usually a broad category, but how through a handful of works of like fiction, they became a very specific taxonomized creature. And when I did that article, I just saw a ton of materials that I didn't think had been really utilized in existing scholarship. I noticed there was a lot of work about like fairies and elves, but I knew goblins were kind of in that milieu, but like less considered. I reached out to a handful of scholars who were very encouraging and very helpful. And so that is the ultimate genesis of this project and how I got involved in it. I'm an admitted outsider here. I'm not trained in folklore like so many. And one of the real difficulties of this project is that it spanned not only like medieval history, which is what I know best, but also like early modern history into the Renaissance and the 18th and 19th century, into works of literature where I'm really not like accustomed to reading scholarship, into like modern pop culture. It's really broad and really scary, and so I know I'm opening myself up to all sorts of critiques by writing such a broad history, but I do hope there's something valuable that comes from it.
I think there's definitely value to kind of taking a stab at it and at least putting a baseline for people to follow, you know, that hopefully they will be kind, because I know what you're saying. I hope everybody will be nice about it, because it's like, The scholarship involved in pulling it together and looking at the chapters. Matt sent me a sample of the book that's coming out in June. The references are amazing. You can dive down into those. I can see that as a reading list, like you were saying. There's a lot of good stuff. If you could ask anyone from the past one question about goblins, who would it be and what would your question be?
Yeah, I know this one right away. So this is, I want to go to the city of Evro in the 12th century. I can magically speak Old French in this narrative. And I just want to ask them, like, tell me about Gobelin or Gobelinus. Like, tell me about this creature. I want to ask anyone around, because that's the earliest written example that we have. And it's from a monk named Odric Vitalis, who describes this demon that the commoners call Goblin. And so I want to know what the commoners think. Like, I know what Odric Vitalis thinks about this. He thinks, you know, it's this, like, neutered demon that was vanquished by the deeds of Saint Tyrannus, but I want to know what the commoners think about this creature. I think that would just be fascinating. It's one of those things where we have so many amazing sources that hint at beliefs of commoners, but virtually nothing from the commoners themselves. So I want to ask your average Joe on the street, like, what do you think of this? It would be such a fascinating, like, look into a world that's largely lost to us.
It's the scholars or the clerics, like you were telling me earlier, that are writing things down, and they're trying to kind of talk the common people out of their pagan belief system. Did anything surprise or particularly delight or you felt was charming in your research that was fun to discover?
The pivot to, like, protagonistic goblins in the last 20 years or so was, like, really delightful. Like, getting to see these children books, like, Nobody Likes a Goblin by Hatkey, which is, like, taking the, like, goblin that in, like, Tolkien and George MacDonald and D&D is just like cannon fodder for adventurers, right? And turning that trope on its head, and, like, the goblin is the misunderstood one who's being aggressed upon by these, like, nosy adventurers, and seeing, like, the underdog goblin win, I thought that was just, like, absolutely, like, adorable and charming. And they're trying to teach, like, I think, a good lesson at the end of the day with that, about the harms of stereotyping.
And that was Nobody Likes a Goblin?
Nobody Likes a Goblin.
Is there any common misunderstanding that you ran into about the definition of goblins?
Oof. Well, I don't know about, like, a misunderstanding, but, like, defining them in the first place is a challenge. You have a couple options. Like, you can say, well, a goblin is a sort of creature that looks like this or does these things or lives in this place. And that's how some have approached it. You have Catherine Briggs or the Standard Dictionary of Folklore. You have these attempts to define based on, you know, someone else imposing a value on this creature. And that's fine. I welcome that. And I think it allows you to talk about goblins across cultural contexts, right? You can compare the goblin to the duende of like Spanish tradition. And the issue I had with that is that I couldn't, like, I was seeing the word goblin used in so many ways in so many contexts that I didn't think it would work to limit myself to a particular, like, category. So what I did is I just said, I'm going to use circular reasoning here. I'm going to say a goblin is a goblin is a goblin. Like, whatever people call goblins, that's what I'm interested in. So I'm really looking at the word over time. And that, I think, is restricting one. Like, I can only really use English and some French sources or translations of other sources, which I get into kind of midway through the book. But it allows me to kind of look at changes in word usage over time, how it's deployed not only to describe a creature, but also, like, metaphorically. Can also be used to describe people, often people who don't look like a good way, according to a certain author. And so that was my approach, and some are going to disagree with it, and I think that's absolutely fine. But I ended up just talking about the word itself. This also had the added benefit of letting me kind of do some quantitative analyses. We have so many online databases now that I can look at the use of the word goblin over time in a way that would be much harder if I was looking at, you know, other spellings or other words alongside it.
It sounded like you were narrowing kind of the scope of it from, like, global demons and mythology and goblin-y kind of things, because that would be kind of overwhelming to kind of categorize all of that. So that I could totally understand. What were the strangest things that you learned about goblins? What stood out as you tried to categorize and pull things together?
There's a lot of, like, directions I could go here. I mean, the strangest and kind of the most, like, disturbing was the way in which certain people were categorized as goblins. I wasn't necessarily expecting that, but you get this strand of thought, and it's not super pronounced, but it exists in the context of like colonial Britain, especially where people of short stature, often with dark skin in Africa, were compared to or seen as like the ancestors of goblins, like the ultimate source of the fairies. And so goblins, fairies, and dwarves are sometimes interchangeable here, but you have these people, they look different, are called goblins in a pejorative sense. It's also applied sometimes to people with disabilities. We have some people who, like with cross eyes, referred to as goblins. And so that kind of dehumanization of people with the label was the thing that was the most jarring and kind of unexpected going into this. I wasn't necessarily thinking that like this word, which has a negative connotation for much of its history, would apply to people, but it's there and it's part of the history.
Yeah, that was startling when I was reading your book description to find out that there was this other side that I had never even understood. I mean, it stands to reason because that ugly side of humanity comes up in history a fair amount, and it's yikes. And it's so sad that people were categorized that way. Jeez. So, okay.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I know.
Yeah. So what it sounds like, goblins were kind of created as explanations for things that went bad for people or misfortunes. I don't know if we want to talk about goblins around the world necessarily, because you're more tied to European goblins. It sounds like your research was more France.
Anglophone is the word I use. So like Anglophone. English language ones. I think like doing cross-cultural work here, I think is what I want other people. Like I don't have the chops to get into Japanese archives or to look at Japanese or Chinese sources, but I know that there are like folklore creatures with some comparative aspects. And so when I get into like, you know, English language people going into the so-called global South, they are classing creatures of like Japanese folklore as goblins, using the label pretty broadly. We also get like Buddhist cosmology being tied in to goblins. And so I can speak to some degree that like the goblin label got applied to a lot of different creatures in a lot of different contexts, often in a way that was meant to like disparage the fairy tales of other religions as Christian missionaries saw them. But like how they popped up in, say, the like Southeast Asia or the subcontinent, like, I can't speak to that specifically. I think I would love for someone with that knowledge to kind of see if what I'm saying makes any sense here, or if I'm off base. Yeah.
You're right. It just kind of blossoms in each culture. And if they're just loosely using the word goblin, I don't know if yokai in particular, or just these different demons or evil spirits, you know, it sounds like they were good spirits too, or considered like the house a gnome or a nis, or like a home spirit. I don't know if they would be considered a goblin though, or a fae.
Yeah, nis, like the Scandinavian Germanic, is often conflated with goblin in works of academic folklore, from what I could see. For the yokai, I just humbly defer to anything that Michael Dylan Foster has written. He's a folklorist based out of UC Riverside, I think, and he wrote a book called The Book of Yokai in 2015. And so I defer to him a few times in the book. He also was one of the coiners, I think, of the term folkloresque, which I might have used already in our discussion, but I do want to like make sure it's a known term. It's a way of talking about those things that are derived from folklore and that in turn influence folklore. So I use sometimes this dyad of folklore and folkloresque, which is a way of talking about the folkloric goblin, which is kind of our earliest examples of it. But then like that is influencing like Shakespearean goblins, but that in turn is influencing the folklore. And so it's like, it's this Mobius strip, which is a image that Foster evokes, of like one influencing the other in a way that we just have a glimpse of from our historical sources.
With the Mobius, is that like the French illustrator?
Like a Mobius strip, like the figure eight looking thing that
doesn't
ever end.
Just for curiosity, I know this is kind of deeper than we were necessarily going to go. Have you heard of any of them being depicted in petroglyphs or really early art or human stories? I had been doing some research, and it kind of just clicked that in The Exorcist, the beginning, they reference a demon. And I looked it up, but I didn't know if it went back that far or if that's really just reaching at that point. you know.
Yeah, I mean, The Exorcist terrified me the first time.
Oh, yeah.
At the time I watched, but I believe that is Pazuzu, the Assyrian god of, it's like death and crops and fertility. I don't know exactly the boundaries.
Uh-huh.
Like, the word goblin itself, like, because of my restrictive definition, I don't really start until the Middle Ages. And so, like, if we're talking about depictions of the Middle Ages, well, if goblin is a demon, then we have some demons that, like, might, like, kind of resemble what the monks were thinking. But if we're going way back to, you know, ancient Mesopotamia, we might be able to conflate, like compare the goblin with some of these creatures. There's some sense that, like, the ultimate origin of the word goblin might have been in ancient Greek, but it's really, really tenuous. And even then, those are in written text. They're not in petroglyphs or engravings. So, could be, but the sense is that, like, with my definition, we're looking more recent.
Recent. That makes sense. Okay. With art history, I didn't get as close of a look as I wanted in the time that I had when I finally got the book printed, but last night I went through your tables and your figures and went and found them all and bookmarked them. So it's a great reference for art history of goblins.
Thank you.
Yeah, I had actually just seen the Arthur Rackham, and I don't remember his name, one of the gentlemen that started the Pre-Raphaelite group.
Oh, Dante Rossetti?
Yes. And so I've gone down rabbit holes with him too for his illustrations. It would be obvious that this would cross over into fairy tales and, you know, with the use of goblins, but it's just interesting that I keep running into these same artists that have illustrated them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it went as early as Gustave Doré and woodblock prints. It kind of looked like it did because there were some stamp-looking things.
Yeah, we have, like, so when we talk about, like, artistic depictions, one of the difficulties of, like, let's say, 1800 is that the term goblin is often a generic term that encompasses, like, fairies and elves and ghosts and spirits. Like, for a lot of those writing about goblins, like, they think these things aren't real. And so, like, what do you call them is kind of irrelevant. Like, it's all a folly implanted by Catholics or something like that, right?
Okay.
Or the ignorant women. It's a gender term there, like the ignorant women who teach it to their kids, and then their kids pass it down, and thus the educated men are angry. So, like, we have depictions of, like, demons, for example, and, like, witches, and the term goblin is sometimes used in that context. So, yeah, in those, like, woodcuts, we might see them in that kind of Christian context. Then when we get works of academic folklore in the 19th century, especially, we start to see more, like, depictions of folkloric goblins or fairy tale goblins. Again, the term is still often kind of vague, but we definitely get it in, say, like, Dickens, for example. Now we're in the world of fiction, but, like, he has Christmas stories about goblins. So we have the pumpkin-headed goblin that harasses the gravedigger Gabriel Grubb, and we have a few depictions of those. One of them is really spooky and gothic, the other a little more cartoony. And my sense is that, like, the vision of goblins that most people have today is the product of the art surrounding, like, Tolkien, to some degree Arthur Rackham, who did a lot of fairy tales, including an edition of Christina Rossetti's Goblin Market in, I think, the 1920s.
Yeah.
One of the things that really struck me when I was, like, looking at depictions of these creatures is the degree to which they're kind of homogenized online. They all goblins, from what I could see, looked really, really similar in recent memory. And one way that I was like, how do I quantify this? I don't know how I can show this, but what I did is I went to a bunch of, like, AI image generators, which are culling swaths of the internet. And I said, like, show me a goblin. And they all looked the same. They were all green creatures with, like, pointy ears and grinning, mischievous, pointed smiles, usually in, like, fantasy tunics with knives and maybe in a cave or a forest. To me, says that, like, the internet input of goblins is this, like, Tolkien-based D&D-inspired fantasy creature, and that doesn't necessarily look at all like what we would see in earlier decades and centuries.
You mentioned in our earlier discussion I think it was the Goblin Builders. I think I found the picture last night as I was going through your book, and it looks almost like a djinn disappearing into the night. You know, it's just very different from these little green creatures that are running around, you know, in Zeppelins or whatever in Warcraft, you know?
Yeah, so. Exactly. And, like, the, like, one of the most, I guess, famous depictions of a goblin from the 19th century is William Blake, who did an illustration based on a pastoral poem by John Milton. And it's a goblin that looks really just like a person, like, evaporating into the night sky, having performed the household labor for the night, the so-called drudging goblin. And it's not at all anything like, apart from the skin being distinctly non-white, like, not really what I think of when I think of this creature.
Yeah. I used ChatGPT to show me some goblins, too, as I was starting my research. Very stereotypical, I guess. It was very, you know, like, okay, this is what a goblin looks like. I'm like, okay, somebody's taught you this. You know, it's like that it's just...
Yeah.
And a lot
These
of
AI
it was...
models are as good as the data they're trained on. And
yeah.
The internet is just full of green goblins that are inspired by Tolkien, probably some Spider-Man in there as well. And that's what is just dominant in online spaces.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And to announce our discussion, I had Chat pull up, because I couldn't paint a picture as fast as Chat. And I know there's a lot of artists that are very, I don't know if bitter is the right word, but they feel it's kind of a ripoff that the AI hits it, you know? But anyway, we have a cute picture of the goblin spilling the tea, like we're talking about the goblin spilling the tea.
Yeah, I am generally against, like, these LLMs. I understand their utility, but I have pretty big reservations. But it did feel good to be able to use it as a way of showing what has happened for, like, the depictions of goblins in art history. To be able to, like, give a sense of, like, hey, I'm not just, like, making this up. Like,
right.
We have a pretty homogenized vision of these creatures.
Yeah, the research that can be, I don't know, shared to give you other research areas, you know, to physically go down is helpful. So yeah, that's opened some doors for me with a lot of the artists. I wanted to talk about kind of mainstream and fringe history of goblins. I don't know if you've had any more time, but you do hit it in your research, if I remember right, the Kelly Hopkinsville. And I think there was an illustration from there, wasn't there, in your book?
I don't think from...
Maybe not.
Hopkinsville. I mean, I know the story generally, but I don't think I touch on that.
Okay. It must be just that I was looking things up. I know you're in a different era with a lot of the research, but like modern things that I've been running into on podcasts, people are telling the story of Kelly Hopkinsville, account of the family home being attacked by goblins. From the beginning, it was kind of like argued, were they drunk? Were they, you know, that was it real? Was it aliens? And that kind of, I guess, is one of the more famous ones that I've heard about. And then there's the Hellier Show, which is Hellier's a town in Kentucky. And they all go visit there and they're documenting their journey as they try and research. Somebody had reported to them that they had seen goblins outside of their house. That opens the story and then they can't find that person, but then they keep getting clues and, you know, journey down the rabbit hole. Do you have thoughts on that? This goes a different direction than, like, Dungeons and Dragons and, like, other modern stuff, like video games and so...
For sure. No, so I'll preface this by saying that, like, I didn't approach this project with the idea that it was my job to, like, determine whether these encounters, these fairy encounters, these goblins encounters actually happened.
Okay.
What's more important for me is to try to understand the world that these people are inhabiting if they think that goblins are real, right?
Right. Okay.
Like, my own perspective on that, I think, is moot. I'm approaching this with trying to get inside the heads, knowing it's impossible, of the people who write about goblins as, like, very real parts of their world. And to this end, I think Simon Young's Fairy Census is a really cool resource. This is a scholar. He's got his PhD. Help me with my introduction for this book. The URL is just fairycensus.com, and it's some 2,000 or so plus reported fairy encounters that people have given to Simon over the course of years. And it's a recently redesigned website. It looks fantastic, and it gives a sense of what people have done. And I'll give you one short example. So this is entry number 144 from Cork, Ireland, a woman aged 51 to 60, and here's what it says. Full moon, Samhain Eve, little goblin-y type men running in and out of bushes, giggling, tumbling, and scurrying around garden. House by side of Burin, you lined it, side, orchard at end, like little men, about 2 feet tall, very dark skin, swarthy with big noses, ragged clothes, streams of music, which was hypnotic but made me feel sick. We had a solid type fog all day, and a farmer had said, who could come down and miss? I just knew it was a fairy. My paternal grandmother was Irish, and when I went to live in Ireland in 2007, I felt I'd gone home. Fairies are, I think, ancestral voices. I've always felt something. I've seen things all my life. I learned when going to school to just keep quiet. I can't explain my experience. I just am thankful for it. So, like, that's an example. And, like, what it says to me is that, like, belief in fairies very much exists, despite centuries and centuries and centuries of people saying, ah, no one believes in fairies anymore, or much fewer people believe in fairies anymore. It's a phenomenon that Barbara Rieti calls the perpetual recession of the fairies. Going as far back as Chaucer, people are like, ah, people don't really believe in fairies anymore. But ironically, people keep saying that, and what that means is that, well, people still obviously do believe in fairies, right? If we keep talking about how no one believes it, it means, well, I guess people are believing in it. This fairy census, I think, gives a sense of it. And there's some quantitative data, I think, from The Guardian or BBC that shows a good number of people believe in it. The number of the location here matters. I think Iceland is an outlier in terms of just the number of people that believe in these supernatural, preternatural creatures that operate just outside of our understanding of how the world works.
Okay. That sounds really interesting. I'm going to have to go look up the fairy census. That sounds great. So we talked about the anthropology question that I wasn't quite sure how to approach, but also I've read about goblins, and I don't know if this is too touchy of a topic. I went into a Reddit, and I guess that's questionable. But anyway, I was just trying to learn what people were thinking, and somebody had seemed to be on like kind of a historical research of it, saying that some people had tied goblins to Jewish people. And I don't know if that's like with Gringotts or, you know.
This was a fascinating rabbit hole because I first encountered this when I was looking at the goblin core aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And there was a banner that said, like, it was like content warning because of like the anti-Semitic character of goblins. I'd done a fair amount of research at this point. I was like, huh, I haven't like seen this thread very pronounced in the historical sources. Mm-hmm. And so I did some internet sleuthing as best I could by looking through like the aesthetic wiki corrections and going to the Goblin Core subreddit and like a few Tumblr posts and stuff like that. And the sense I get is that there is a strand of people who really latched on to the anti-Semitic goblins of the Harry Potter movies in particular, where I do think there's like anti-Semitic tropes in these goblins of Gringotts. I actually think it's less pronounced in the books, but I do think it's there's some troubling aspects to it in the films. It's something Jon Stewart picked up on in one of his podcasts. And I think that is front and center in a lot of people's minds and their depictions of goblins. And so then they looked for historical precedent and found some very isolated examples that I don't think always hold up under close scrutiny. And that became like the foundation for this idea that goblins are anti-Semitic creatures. I don't think there's anything inherently anti-Semitic in the creature itself, though some depictions of them are. What I see more in these internet discussions are like correlation instead of causation. And so like you have caricature depictions of Jews with certain facial features exaggerated. Goblins have similarly exaggerated facial features, and people are drawing a connection to those. What I think is actually happening is that in a lot of Christian societies, especially in Europe, those who are not Christian, those who transgress proper norms, are literally ugly as sin, and so they're deformed. And so this means that the folkloric creatures are deformed, those who are not Christians are deformed, and so we have this connection that I think is very, very tenuous. But what I think happens in this discussion is that there's this discussion of anti-Semitism. But what I think it does is it blocks out what I think is the more troubling history of goblins, which is the association of certain people with physical disability or short stature or dark skin. Like, that's where I would want to see the content warning.
Yeah.
And with regards to the anti-Semitism too, I just think it's hard to argue that there's this like consistent through line for goblins. because we have like a Caldecott medalist writing a book called Herschel and the Hanukkah Goblins. We also have a book called There's a Goblin on the Ark, which is about like transgender inclusivity, using the goblin as an example from, you know, the Bible. And so, like, there are certainly a few isolated examples in which I think we can say, yeah, these goblins are drawing on anti-Semitic tropes. I think that's true of, probably true of every folklore creature, because anti-Semitism has been, unfortunately, ingrained in Christian European societies for hundreds of years. And that was one particularly, like, unexpected thread that I really had to parse. I really wanted to make sure I wasn't discounting these arguments being posited online. I never want to discount anti-Semitism. So right. I had to be like really careful in researching and writing this, because I didn't want to dismiss the very real anti-Semitism that exists in the world. But yeah. I also think in this case, it's not as pronounced as some are making it to be, and it's obfuscating these more like discriminatory and I think troubling historical through lines.
Very troubling, yeah. That's interesting that you ran into that too. And John Stewart had said something. Are there any things that you feel goblins reveal about us as humankind that's dead on? And it may be, I don't know if it's all necessarily negative or just our common need of these explanations and stories. Kind of like when I first read Joseph Campbell, and there are other authors now, you know, that tie kind of the different myths and the repeating story patterns across humanity. That it's kind of something we've all needed as we explain our world. Is there anything you've found in particular like that? I don't know, now that we've talked about the negative things that human mind can do as far as stereotyping other people.
Yeah, I think there's a few ways I could approach this. And I'm not a psychologist or an anthropologist, so I feel like my ability to make overarching statements about humanity
is
limited. But what I'd say in the case of goblins is kind of getting at what you just said, is that I think they serve as a kind of powerful, like, way in which people of different societies have tried to depict something that is abnormal or weird or atypical. And this means that, like, the goblin can manifest in very different ways, because people have thought that what is weird or different is varied over time. And so we can go from terrifying to confusing to prejudiced and racist to light skin to dark skin. There's lots of different ways, and I think that like fundamental alterity, the otherness, like of the goblin, has given it like remarkable longevity. But it also means it's been tied up in all of these like troubling undercurrents. Funnily though, I think it has like kind of the goblin itself has had a bit of a moment in the last like 10 years, where like the goblin for so long was this like creature of ugliness, or this idea of ugliness and darkness and being brooding and away from society, that it became like the perfect kind of foil for the absurdity of social expectations in the 2020s, especially around the time of COVID. And so you have Goblin Core as this like reclamation of ugly, in quotes, spaces, like an appreciation of beauty where some see ugliness. And you also have Goblin Mode as this like form of ultimately like countercultural self-care or slovenliness. You know, we could have used any creature to coin these terms, but the goblin was ultimately that one. So I think if we turn the trope on its head, we take the goblin from that creature that's on the margins and ugly and asocial, and we instead say, hey, that creature gets it because our society is so messed up. And so I think that's kind of a fitting kind of conclusion to the book, is this total reframing of the goblin's traits as an asset when our own societies are so monstrous.
I'm definitely going to be reading the book in its entirety and not just quick research, because it's such a deep perspective, I think, that I'll end up with at the end. And it'll answer a lot of these questions, I think, as I go. So I'm looking forward to that. Moving on to video games and gamers, I guess there's Dungeons and Dragons, and I don't know if they had them in Heroes Quest, but there's board games as well as video games. In general, how do you feel about goblins in that world? And like I've run into also some of the games that are, at first I'm like, oh, maybe that'll be fun, and then I open the game and it's a little risque, or it's, you know, and I'm like, oh, they're making goblin women more suggestive than just an ugly creature. And so I don't know, just in general, how are video games and goblins going?
If we go back to like D&D, kind of the biggest like first tabletop RPG game, mm-hmm. they are cannon fodder. They're evil. They're essentially like copy pasted from Tolkien. And that exists for quite a while. Like goblins are just like low level creatures that you kill for golden experience.
Okay.
That's what you do. Like they are just low level foils for heroic adventurers. And then in the 80s and 90s, we start to see some game developers be like, okay, this is getting a bit boring. And so you can sometimes play as goblin characters, or goblin characters can be a little bit more misunderstood. You know, people think that they're these cave dwellers with no technology, but actually they're very crafty and they're very good and they can navigate in low light and they have all these like role-playing opportunities that accompany it. And that has really exploded alongside like the boon in fantasy literature since the 1990s, where we now have these series where like goblins are protagonists. You know, you have Styx, for example, S-T-Y-X. It's like goblin that can wield magic. You have like indie games in which goblins are like, you are refurbishing old loot to be sold to people. Like, and you play as a goblin shop owner there. You have a tabletop RPG where you are playing as three goblins in a coat trying to like get through a fantasy world. So you get the like vestiges of that kind of Tolkien and D&D origin, mm-hmm. but just expanded to fit like the breadth of fantasy worlds that exist in our imaginations. And I think that's really, really great. I like to see these fantasy tropes like changing so they're not just like really stale. And with regards to what you said near the end there, I noticed too that like there was a lot of like essentially erotica that featured female goblins. And there was this dichotomy I saw in fantasy universes. And here I mean fantasy broadly, not like sexual fantasy, but like male goblins typically are these like cave-dwelling brutes that attack people. But then you get like servile, submissive, kinky female goblins. And I imagine this is like reflected in a lot of other fantasy creatures too, where it's like the men ought to be fought, the women ought to be seduced and conquered, really. And this is like a reflection of the kind of narrative seen in a lot of these fantasy games. And so I started to see that. I didn't have time to really write about it much, but I do think there's something interesting there. And at one point I went to one of these like archives of like this kind of literature, and I noticed all it seemed like, and I'm sure there's exceptions here, but most of the goblins were women, most of the orcs were men. And so there's this way in which in these kind of like erotic spaces, different creatures are being slotted into different fantasies, essentially.
To see that happen with modern illustrators and the teams that are building these games. Having a background with Scrum and those kind of projects that require a team, it's not just one person going off usually, and it's like the team's like, ooh, good idea, you know, let's develop that. I did have one question before we go to the conclusion, which we have 5 minutes. But I was wondering, have you seen the image, the painting of the nightmare? It's a...
Oh, yeah. It's the creature on top of the woman who's sleeping.
Yeah. Is that supposed to be a goblin, do you think, or just an incubus, or...?
I think I've seen it described as a goblin before, but I typically see it, yeah, as that, like, kind of... as an incubus, because there's kind of a sexual undertone to it.
It just kind of looks like the goblins as they were portrayed in the gnome book and, you know, kind of other, like, art books in the 80s. You know,
yeah. So these things are so interchangeable that like it definitely like it could be.
Yeah, I know there's like a horse and everything in there. So they're trying to tie it into mythology of nightmares. And are you going to be going to any conferences or having any signings coming up with the book?
Nothing. Well, nothing related to goblins at this point, but we'll see. I had a kid about a year ago, and so I've toned down my conference movements a little bit.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
To you guys on the baby. Are there any common misconceptions about goblins you'd like to correct or anything else you'd like to share?
I think I just want to say that, like, there is no singular definition of a goblin, right? Like, it's been viewed across historical contexts in many different ways by many different people, and we shouldn't think that there is, like, one true goblin, right? For every person, you know, there's that many visualizations and definitions of these creatures.
That's become a lot more clear to me in the conversation we've had, that it's not a very clear-cut definition. Is there a place where people could go? Do you have a website? Or if they wanted to kind of stay in touch about books you'll be working on or online classes or anything like that?
I mean, my faculty profile page at the University of South Florida would be the best place to go. My email's matthewking1@usf.edu. So anyone who's interested is welcome to reach out. I, you know, have just finished this book project, and I'm waiting to see what people think of it. Like, I have no idea how this is going to be reviewed, and truth be told, I'm quite anxious about it. Like, I really don't know what the response will be to this, either from, like, non-academic readers or academic readers. So I'm working on some other more medieval projects right now as I wait to see what happens with the book, but that response will kind of inform where I go next.
Well, I think it's an admirable effort in going through it. Yeah, you've done a great job. Okay, well, I guess we can wrap it up. And I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to cover, or I can create another meeting if you feel we've missed anything. Or
no, I think we hit things. Thank you, Suzanne. This was really lovely. And I appreciate you reaching out and taking the time to talk.
Oh, sure. And you too. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much, Suzanne.
Okay, good luck.
See
ya.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for joining us and guiding us through the shadowy history of goblins, from medieval fears and folklore to the creatures that we still talk about who are lurking in the dark. This was great. The Whispering Gallery podcast is written and produced by me, Suzanne Nicolaisen. Copyright Suzanne Nicolaisen, 2026. All media was used under the protection of fair use. You can support the podcast by volunteering or donating. Links are at thewhisperinggallerypodcast.com. The score for the podcast is Spellcraft, provided by Jeff Harvey on Pixabay. Remember to keep your flashlight close and your spooky art stories closer when visiting the Whispering Gallery. Take care.